Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday the 26th of May, these are our main stories. Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam rejects concerns that a national security bill proposed by China will curtail civil rights. Egypt's health minister orders an investigation into the death of a doctor who contracted COVID-19 while at work. And the Afghan government urges the Taliban to extend its three-day ceasefire. Also in this podcast, Greece opens up again to visitors, but the impact of the pandemic on its tourism sector may outlive the virus.
It's about time to accept that the world has changed. So things don't run on the way they were running. Now we have to start learning new things.
And rats on the rampage in New York. Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam has made her first public comments on a controversial national security law planned by China. The proposed law would ban treason, secession, sedition and subversion, but critics say it would limit the city's freedoms. Now Ms. Lam has defended the law, saying it is a responsible move to protect the law-abiding majority. She also criticised other countries for interfering in its affairs.
For overseas politicians who making such comments, they probably, you know, practicing double standard. Now, I think there is no one country that would allow an important matter like national security to be flawed in any way or to have a void in any way.
Our correspondent in Beijing is Stephen McDonnell. I asked him whether he believed Carrie Lam's words would reassure people.
No. I mean, those who support this new national security law would support it. Those who oppose it, oppose it. And Carrie Lam, frankly, a very unpopular leader, has extremely limited ability in terms of swinging the population in favour of, well, of anything there, really. And so, you know, other than her sort of rusted-on pro-Beijing camp-type support group, the vast majority of people seem to oppose this move, and whether she says anything reassuring about it or not is neither here nor there, actually.
Beijing has proposed laws that haven't made it onto the statute books before, though. Will this one make it through when it goes to a vote this week?
So the difference this time is that in the past, such a move, this national security law, which, to give you a small indication of the importance of it, might mean that if you're protesting, instead of being charged with rioting, say, or sort of assembly laws, you might face laws to do with sedition and threatening to overthrow the Communist Party, this type of thing, which would potentially lead you to spending decades in prison. So a very serious change in approach. In the past, it's been so unpopular, this proposal, even with a rigged local government there. And the pro-Beijing camp, they can't lose control of that, basically, that because of the way the voting works. It was so unpopular that they couldn't even get it through the local government there, that some of the pro-Beijing camp wouldn't support it on the floor of the Legislative Council. So now the national government has decided just to stick it on the mini-constitution for the whole city, and it's doing that this week in Beijing through the National People's Congress. Now, in the National People's Congress, it's basically a rubber stamp assembly. It'll go through for sure without much of a challenge.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. Egypt's health minister has ordered an investigation into the death of a doctor who contracted COVID-19 while on duty. It comes after the doctors' union accused the health ministry of negligence after several health workers have died. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me about the doctor who had lost his life.
He was a young doctor, Dr. Walid Yahya. He died on Saturday. Now, the concern over his death is that he was unable to get the treatment he needed to get into a unit where he could have the emergency treatment. He was in a crowded hospital. His brother posted on Facebook a very emotional response to his death, saying that he was with him with other colleagues at the time. They were desperately calling for help, but they didn't get any response. This essentially fits a pattern of what doctors and health workers have been saying has been happening in Egypt, in the hospitals, since coronavirus hit. And it triggered a statement from the doctors' union denouncing the health ministry, saying that it was negligent, saying that it was fully responsible for the deaths. The union said of 19 doctors and more than 350 health workers infected since the outbreak started. In response to that, we've now had the health minister say that an investigation is going to be launched, an emergency investigation into the death of Dr. Walid Yahya. This apparently is at the direct behest of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Obviously, this is very bad for the image of the government and for its handling. So it's definitely making efforts to look as if they are responding and are taking action.
Just how badly affected by the coronavirus is Egypt?
Well, the number of recorded cases is almost at 18,000 and the deaths just under 800. I mean, there's been problems as far as the Egyptian public concerned over the way the government has handled it. The government hasn't, or certainly didn't, move quickly to close down the country, to put it into lockdown, as we've seen in a lot of other Middle East countries. I mean, it is the most populous country in the Arab world. It is a country where obviously the health system is already under strain. There isn't the money around for it. So there's been criticism over that. And doctors have said, look, you know, we've been hailed as heroes. They've been dubbed the White Army, saying we don't want songs. We don't want poems about us. We want the protective equipment that we need in order to do our job, not just for us, but for our patients. And they've been complaining for weeks that they've not been getting that. And that's certainly been a major issue that people in Egypt have been concerned about and have been airing their concerns online.
Sebastian Usher. Yemen is already suffering what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. We've been hearing from a doctor who is working at Medecins Sans Frontières' only COVID-19 clinic in Yemen.
My name is Kyril Musa. I am an intensive care doctor from Sydney, Australia, working with Medecins Sans Frontières in our COVID-19 treatment facility in Yemen. It's been challenging, to say the least. Many patients are presenting to our facility quite late in their illness with severe respiratory distress and sort of unbelievably low oxygen levels, some as low as 40%. And that's really not anything I've ever seen before in my career. They tend to be quite young, much younger than what we're seeing elsewhere in the world in the 40 to 60 age range, some as young as 20. And unfortunately, we're really quite restricted in terms of the care that we can provide them due to lack of resources. Capacity for testing is really restricted. We don't have enough PPE for our staff. We don't have enough equipment or medicines or even means to supply oxygen to these patients. And many of them are dying in quite horrific ways, gasping for breath. And it is really, really distressing to watch. MSF are trying our hardest to do the best we can with the little we have, but we need a lot of support. Yemen is only at the beginning of this outbreak, and we fear that the situation is likely to get worse over the coming weeks.
Dr. Kharil Musa. Tajikistan told the world it was free of coronavirus up until the end of April. Then the secretive country, which borders China in the east, confirmed its first cases. The World Health Organization says COVID-19 is now spreading in the country. Latest official figures say 46 people have died. But a list compiled by citizens claims it's more than 300. The BBC's Rehan Dimitri reports.
On March the 22nd, in the northern Tajik city of Khojand, a giant sports stadium was filled with spectators. On the ground, thousands participated in a display celebrating Navruz, the spring equinox. The country's president of 27 years, Emomali Rahmon, attended.
Navruz, Mubarak, Muadi, Hamma,
The mass public gathering went ahead against the recommendations of the World Health Organization, while Tajikistan's neighbors were closing themselves off to stop the spread of COVID-19. Tajikistan officially remained coronavirus free. A pro-government video posted on YouTube called journalists who reported on suspicious deaths traitors. The Tajik health ministry said the deaths were due to pneumonia-like infections and blamed them on bad weather. Mehrangiz Tursunzoda is a journalist with Asia Plus, an online news service currently blocked in Tajikistan. One of her colleagues who was mocked in that video was later assaulted by unknown attackers. Doctors have also been put under pressure. One doctor told me they sent CT scans to Russia in March and confirmed COVID-19, Mehrangiz said. But the security services ordered them to register all the cases as pneumonia. The doctors would only speak to Mehrangiz anonymously. None were prepared to speak to the BBC. The Tajik authorities finally confirmed the first COVID-19 cases in the country on April 30th in an announcement on state Tajikistan TV channel. So why the delay? Edward Lemon is a British academic who specializes in Tajik politics. He believes among the possible reasons is that the 67-year-old President Rahmon wanted to make sure his son Rustam was in position to take over from him if circumstances demanded.
April 17th, the president's son, who is also mayor of the capital city, 32 years old, he was elected Speaker of the Upper House of Parliament, and that effectively makes him second in line to the presidency. With an ongoing healthcare crisis that has sort of reached many of the upper echelons of power, you know, a number of members of the presidential family reportedly falling sick, members of the security services, senior members. So, you know, I think it's plausible to say that he wanted to have that succession issue settled before we enter this period of uncertainty.
According to the head of a recent World Health Organization mission to Tajikistan, the country is not past the worst. The WHO says that just as elsewhere, it is vital that the country can increase its capacity to test, especially in the regions. Tajikistan's northern Sugd region, where those mass spring celebrations were held, is now the epicenter of the disease.
Rayhan Dimitri. Still to come.
His casinos were responsible for between 50 to 70% of all of Macau's tax revenues.
The casino tycoon Stanley Ho, who transformed Macau into the world's biggest gambling hub, has died at the age of 98. The Afghan government has urged the Taliban to extend a three-day ceasefire which is due to end on Tuesday night. A spokesperson for the National Security Council said it was important to avoid further bloodshed. There's been no immediate response from the Taliban. With the details, here's our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan.
After months of violence across the country, Afghans enjoyed a relatively peaceful Eid, though the celebrations were restricted by the coronavirus outbreak. The ceasefire declared for the festival of Eid was largely holding across the country, and it triggered hopes of an extended truce. The government says it's willing to extend the ceasefire if the Taliban reciprocate. It's also releasing nearly 900 Taliban prisoners, the biggest group to be freed so far. The prisoner exchange is part of a deal between the US and the Taliban signed earlier this year. About 1,100 Taliban members have been freed so far, and the militants have set free about 300 soldiers, officials and locals. The prisoner swap is expected to lead to an intra-Afghan peace dialogue.
Anbarasan Etarajan. Greece has taken another major step in ending its pandemic lockdown. The world-famous Acropolis is now open, and yesterday its islands opened to domestic tourists for the first time in 18 months. On June the 15th, foreign tourists will no longer have to undergo a quarantine. Quentin Somerville has this report.
Early to lockdown, Greece is one of the first to emerge from this pandemic. Not unscathed, it has lost 172 people to COVID-19, but it has fared better than most. The Acropolis has just reopened. It usually has 20,000 tourists a day. Now, barely 100. There's usually a dozen guides here. Now it's only Yanis. He says he's had no customers at all today.
If the Western civilization was a monument, was an image, it couldn't be anything else than what is on the top of that hill up there. So it's by far the most iconic image that Greece exports.
It's quite tragic, isn't it?
It is. It's different. But it's different like everything at the moment. I mean, it's about time to accept that the world has changed.
Foreign tourists have to do a 2-week quarantine, but that will end on June the 15th, when most countries will be welcomed back here. Places with high infection rates, including Britain, the United States and Russia, will have to wait until later. The Greek tourism minister is Haris Theoharis.
I think everyone deserves a break. So they should. I mean, irrespective of whether they come to Greece or not, they should try to find the ways to refill those batteries. Everybody has been under stress. I think this vacationing process is a healing process, especially for this year.
And Greece is pressing ahead. Its islands are open again to domestic tourists. Bars and restaurants are reopening to guests. We took a boat to the Cyclades. Melos Island and Kimolos have chalk cliffs and white, white beaches. The sea, which we're bobbing in at the moment, is a deep blue. These islands have been a safe haven from the pandemic. There haven't been any confirmed cases. That's going to be more challenging as hundreds of thousands of tourists begin to head here. A flotilla of fast boats arrives from the mainland. On board are doctors and charity workers here to give the islanders their first COVID-19 tests. Dr. Aris Papapetropoulos is part of the group.
We will be in contact with the government whenever they need us. We will come here to check if there is any case of COVID infection.
An hour onward, over choppy waters, we arrive at the island of Sikinos. The mayor greets us with elbow bumps instead of a handshake. The village was built on a hilltop to safeguard it from pirates. They're hoping its isolation continues to offer protection. There are only 250 people on this island, and none of them have been tested for COVID-19 until today. Greece is emerging from the pandemic earlier than others. Isolation is a way of life here, but so too is tourism, and the health of the islanders depends on both.
Quentin Somerville. The lockdown is not just having an impact on humans, but also rats. In the United States, unable to dine out on waste from restaurants, hotels and bars, hungry rats have been resorting to open warfare and even cannibalism, according to the US Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Carney Sharp spoke to rodentologist Robert Corrigan.
For many years in some of these cities like New York and London and others, the rats also benefit from our restaurants. When we put out all that trash after everybody goes home, a lot of it is fresh food, and they've learned for decades to just come out and feed from the garbage from all our restaurants. And because of that, we've grown rats into the millions in many of our cities.
Indeed. And now we see an increase in rodent activity because the restaurants are not open. How big an increase?
That's exactly right. With all that food trash now that's not available, that was available, rats are showing up that are looking for the food that was there for years, and they're quite hungry. Quite a few of them are scrambling around looking disoriented. Some of them are traveling, and they're traveling to people's properties and trying to get beneath doors. So it's a situation where there's not more rats, but there is more activity seen by people of these rats that are hungry and disoriented.
People aren't going to be happy about that, are they?
No, and we shouldn't be happy about that. I mean, it's a great animal. Rats are actually a great, wonderful, magnificent mammal. But unfortunately, they come out of sewers and dirty areas and alleys, and they have germs all over their body. So we really don't want rats living in close proximity to us.
The other thing is, Robert, isn't it? They're displaying now aggressive behavior because they're hungry. So that's the other thing that people should be concerned about, shouldn't they?
Yes, but they're, most of the aggression is towards other rats. You know, just like any mammal, when it's hungry, it's going to get in a bad mood, if you will. And so anything that looks like food is going to be attacked, and they'll attack one another and kill one another and consume one another. So, but they're not necessarily going to attack people during this event. The aggression's towards each other.
They're also resorting to cannibalism when it comes to each other. Tell us a bit about that, Robert.
They are. And, you know, they're getting into some wars over a bag of food sometimes in alleyways and what have you. And we are hearing them. People call in and they say, I'm hearing all these rats fighting down below my window. And so we have pictures of rats the next morning that have gotten into wars, and the losers are left there all consumed and just torn apart by the stronger rats.
Getting rid of them, how do you do that? Because there are many precautions that need to be taken.
Well, actually, it's kind of a paradox. It's simple, at the same time, sometimes complex. The best way to not have to get rid of rats is don't attract them in the first place. And so if you want rats, it's simple. Just don't do your trash correctly and don't seal up your doors. And if you live in a neighborhood or a big city like London or New York City or any of the big cities, if you don't do your trash well and you leave gaps beneath your doors, it's almost guaranteed sooner or later you're going to get some rodent visitors.
You have been warned. Robert Corrigan. The man nicknamed the King of Gambling, Stanley Ho, has died at the age of 98. Ho, a Hong Kong-born businessman, investor and philanthropist, ran a casino empire in Macau for decades and was credited for giving the city the title of the world's gambling capital. I heard more about him from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Oh, he was a legend. That's because he basically started his own industry. Stanley Ho, back in the 1960s, his tiny company won the right to monopoly over opening casinos in Macau. At the time, Macau was basically a sleepy backwater. It was a former Portuguese colony right next to Hong Kong. He took this and ran with it and opened up multiple casinos. Until 2002, he had a monopoly on gaming in Macau. High rollers from mainland China and basically all over Asia would flock to Macau. At one point, he was so important, his casinos were responsible for between 50 to 70% of all of Macau's tax revenues. And so he established a massive empire, not just in gaming, but also in construction, transportation, horse racing. And so he did very, very well for himself. He built an empire, but also he was a huge character. He had 17 children. In later years, his children formed alliances with each other, fought each other off in order to gain a slice of that lucrative empire.
Yeah, a multi-billionaire. But he apparently told his children, despite the way that he made his own money, he told them not to become gamblers.
Yes, he was very clear. In fact, he's also said in interviews, look, the house always wins. It's set up to win. So unless you accept that, don't bother gambling. He was very clear about that. But, you know, many people ignored his advice and went to his casinos anyway. Though I must say, in recent years, Macau really has been taken over by Las Vegas companies, by American foreign investors coming in. So his own casinos have declined in significance. We really hadn't heard much from him since 2009, when he fell in his bathroom and suffered quite a serious brain injury. But his influence really cannot be overstated. He's been a huge figure in Hong Kong and Macau since the 1960s.
Celia Hatton with that report. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, You can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
These days, finding the right foundation is harder than ever. Il Makiage makes it easy to find your perfect match online. No store required. With 50 shades of flawless coverage and over 60,000 five-star reviews, the hype is real. Their online quiz uses AI to find your ideal shade in seconds. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.